Okie dokie. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, this first Sunday of the new year, we're going to be talking about labor, the labor movement, organized labor, how it's treated by the media, its relationship with the media, and what the prospects are for labor going ahead in both an economic crisis and with a change in administration. We've got a couple of great guests for you, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But before we go to today's program, let's go to Media Minutes.
Opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This week, Media Minutes looks at five of the top stories of 2008. The fight for a free and open internet took a big step forward at the FCC in August. In a landmark decision that was called a bellwether case for the future of the internet, a bipartisan majority at the agency forced Comcast to stop blocking and publicly disclose its method for interfering with lawful internet traffic. Comcast blocked legal peer-to-peer content by sending fake signals that cut off the connection between file sharers. The FCC vote followed a months-long investigation launched in response to a legal complaint filed by Free Press and Public Knowledge. The FCC held a series of hearings on Comcast's blocking, including one at Harvard University, where the company was caught paying people to fill up seats and crowd out the public. The August decisions was the first time the agency had taken action to protect users' rights to access the internet content of their choice.
Throughout 2008, the FCC turned out some major decisions for wireless broadband and the internet. As the year began, speculation about the auction of a prime slice of the public airwaves, called the 700 megahertz spectrum, reached a fevered pitch. Public interest groups were cheered when the FCC issued requirements that a portion of the prized spectrum must be open to any phone or device. But their celebration was short-lived when Verizon won the auction in March with a $9.4 billion bid. AT&T was the other big winner in the auction. By allowing the dominant phone companies to gain an even bigger wireless footprint, the FCC wiped out a chance to create meaningful competition for wireless broadband. Prospects brightened in November, however. Bucking pressure from broadcasters, the wireless phone industry, and wireless microphone companies, the FCC cleared the way for new technology to use empty TV channels known as white spaces to connect millions to the internet. New devices using what's been called Wi-Fi on steroids could be on the market in the next 18 months.
In April, the New York Times uncovered a shocking scheme in which the Pentagon spread favorable views of the Iraq War by recruiting and planting military analysts in the nation's news media. While these ex-military officers were being coached by the Pentagon and simultaneously consulting for military contractors, they appeared as allegedly independent military analysts on every major cable and broadcast network. Not only did the networks fail to disclose their conflicts, but after the Times expose appeared, they failed to cover that story and continued to employ many of the same analysts. Still, more than 100,000 letters were sent to Congress demanding an investigation, and the House voted in May to outlaw the Defense Department from spreading propaganda to the American public. That news didn't get covered by the major networks either.
Dozens of journalists from independent and mainstream publications, including Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And a photographer from the Associated Press, were arrested trying to cover protests outside the 2008 Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, in September. Journalists were roughed up by police officers, detained anywhere from several hours to several days, and had their equipment and film confiscated. Though largely ignored in the round-the-clock convention coverage, thousands of people still deluge city officials with calls and emails demanding the journalists be released. After activists converged on City Hall to deliver more than 50,000 petitions, the journalists were let go and all charges were dropped. However, calls for an investigation into preemptive raids before the convention and the targeting of the media have gone unheeded.
In 2008, grassroots media activists across the country hit the ground running to educate and organize for changes to our media system. Grassroots activists are sharing winning strategies and connecting media issues to social justice through innovative projects like New York's People's Production House and partnerships like MAGNET, the Media Action Grassroots Network. After the FCC passed rules gutting media ownership limits in the waning days of 2007, media reformers turned up the heat on Congress, prompting a Senate vote to overturn the FCC's actions. Public access television producers got organized and brought their concerns to Washington, catching the attention of Congress and in states like Illinois, where the Attorney General is investigating the mistreatment of community television channels by AT&T. Community radio advocates built new stations from the ground up and collected more than 100 co-sponsors in Congress to support the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would create thousands of new low-power FM radio stations. This legislation, promoted by the tireless advocates at the Prometheus Radio Project, could finally become law in 2009.
To hear these stories and many more from 2008, go to the Media Minutes archives at freepress.net/media-minutes.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. Again, I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you this first January 4th, 2009, with a live broadcast. And I thought a good way to kick off the year would be to turn to a subject that receives very little attention in the news media, despite its significance in our society, and a subject I think will be returning to the fore politically and economically for the next year. So it's a good time to discuss it on a program like Media Matters. The subject, of course, is labor, the labor movement, organized labor, where it stands today, how it got here, where it's going, and the role of media in all this, how press coverage, news media coverage of labor issues, of the labor movement and organized labor. We're very fortunate today in Media Matters to have two terrific guests for the task at hand. Joining me right here in the mobile studio is the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, the president for the past 14 years, I think, and former member of the executive executive council of the National AFL-CIO, one of the most knowledgeable people on organized labor that I know, which is a short list. David Newby, thank you for joining us, David.
Good to be here, Bob.
And joining us on the phone from New Jersey, where she's a professor at Rutgers University, is Deepa Kumar. Deepa is the author of the book Outside the Box, Corporate Media, Globalization, and the UPS Strike. She has written widely on politics and media and news media coverage of social movements, and is as much an expert on press coverage of labor as anyone I know. Deepa Kumar, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start with some basics, David. You know, one of the things about that we were talking about before we went on air, David Newby, was that labor issues in general aren't especially well-known, especially to a younger generation of Americans. So sort of that connection to that part, crucial part of American history, not distant history, but even recent history, doesn't get much treatment in the schools, gets very little press coverage, as we'll talk about during this show. So it's sort of a movement that's almost exotic in a way, because it's so foreign to the experience people have growing up in our country. And the reason I thought of this, I was just talking to a couple friends yesterday who were over for dinner, and they said, you know, they were looking at some research on the 50th anniversary of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO being formed, and they were amazed at all the press coverage it got. All the labor reporters from daily newspapers around the state who came to cover it, it was a front page story everywhere, and just casually remarked, you know, today, that would never happen. There wouldn't be those reporters in the first place, and even if there were reporters, they wouldn't be labor reporters, they'd be covering something else.
There are no labor reporters. Well, I think there's one labor reporter left.
In the state? No. In the country, yeah. And you know how many, Deepa, actually I'd draw you in earlier than I thought I would. Offhand, do you have some sense of how many labor beat reporters there were on daily newspapers, say, 50 or 60 years ago?
Well, actually, I think the attention to labor issues is correlated with the strength of the labor movement. So at the high point, one of the high points of labor activity, which was in the 1930s, it was quite standard for most newspapers that had medium to large circulation to actually have a labor reporter. And, of course, you also had radical and alternative news media outlets that covered things like Appeal to Reason and so on that also covered the labor movement quite regularly. Unfortunately, though, that since the labor movement has been in decline, we've also, and since the emergence of these massive conglomerated giants that we have today, the existence of a labor report has become almost non-existent. So you have, you know, a labor reporter, the New York Times, Stephen Greenhouse, but But he kind of doubles up and goes back and forth between business reporting and labor reporting. You similarly have, you know, labor reporters at the Washington Post and so on. But largely, this is a non-existent beat. And when you compare it with the amount of coverage that business gets, it's truly astounding. You have an entire business section in almost every newspaper. You have entire television channels that are dedicated to Wall Street, to business news, and so on. And labor news is almost invisible in comparison.
Our guests, Deepa Kumar, who you've just been listening to, and David Newby, head of the president of the state of Wisconsin, AFL-CIO. We're talking about labor, the state of labor today and labor's relationship with the news media, both today and in the past and perhaps in the future. David, you know, to give some sense of what Deepa Kumar was just talking about, what roughly was the percentage of the workforce that were part of organized labor, say, in 1950 or and how has it changed over the last 60 years?
1950 really was the height of labor's influence and power, and about 35-36% of wage workers were members of unions in the early 1950s. Today, that's down to 12%.
So it's a big drop.
It's a big drop. A lot of people will say that, you know, membership is declining. That actually is not true. There are about the same number of union members today as there were in 1950, about a little over 15 million.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the workforce has grown, and so our percentage has dropped. But actually, the total numbers of union members have been growing in the last couple of years.
What have been the growth sectors?
Primarily the service sector, low-wage mm-hmm. Workers in the service sector and the healthcare sector.
And, you know, what were the factors you'd say that account for the fact that labor did not grow with the size of the workforce since 1950, that it's not 45 million organized workers today instead of 15 million?
Part of it is certainly our own fault, that labor, I think, became complacent in the later 50s, in the 1960s, 70s. Did not see a need to be growing and to be organizing, and so resources were not put into to attracting more members and organizing new firms. In the early 1950s, the major industries were dominated by unions, even if they did not have a majority of the workers in those sectors.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of it was simply the shift in the economy itself, that as the service sector became larger and a larger percentage of the total workforce, that was not a sector that unions had traditionally organized in. Although there were quite a few retail workers and, you know, even restaurant workers who were organized in the mm-hmm. 30s and the 40s. But it was that shift in the American economy that the American labor movement did not adjust to. And so it kept to its traditional industries, which were flat in terms of employment or in terms of manufacturing, even declining to a certain degree.
Our guest today, David Newby, president of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO, joining us here in the mobile studio. Also on the line from Rutgers, Professor Deepa Kumar, author of Outside the Box, Corporate Media, Globalization, and the UPS Strike. Joining us to talk about these issues. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for either David Newby or Deepa Kumar, the telephone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Deepa, following up sort of the decline of labor that David Newby just outlined, in your view, what role does press coverage play? Is it simply a dependent variable that lags afterward in response to its decline, or does it participate in the decline of labor?
That's a good question. I just want to add a little more to what David just mentioned about okay. why labor has declined, and then I'll come to that. And that is, I think that in addition to the factors that he mentioned, what also took place in the the post-Second World War era is that there was a massive business assault. Business saw what had happened in the 1930s, and we had the largest strike wave after the Second World War and so on. And so there was an organized campaign to actually get rid of radicals, of course. This is what McCarthyism was about, but to also diminish the influence of labor unions on society as a whole. And so that sort of sets the stage then for going into the late 1960s and the early 1970s, which is that the model that the capitalist class was using was in trouble. We see a situation where the U.S. has declined relative to its competitors, particularly Japan and Germany and so on. And so it was necessary to actually adopt a new model. And this new model, which we call today neoliberal globalization, was fundamentally about destroying unions and placing power back in the hands of the business class. And that's what they did, really, in so many ways. Privatization, deregulation, and so on was about this process. And I think labor was slow to realize what neoliberalism was actually going to mean. And I think the Chrysler bailout, which I believe was in 1978 or round about then, instead of taking a more confrontationist approach, unfortunately, the UAW accepted a number of concessions, and that sort of became the trend, so that we go into the 80s with all the major unions granting tons of concessions. And when that's what the labor movement becomes, it's not very inspiring for unorganized workers. That is to say, you will join a union only if there are some real benefits to be gained from joining a union. Unfortunately, the pattern has been, it's at least among the leadership of the AFL-CIO, is to accept this pattern of partnership, which Paul Buell and others talk about quite well. So I think that's been some of the difficulty as well. And I hope we can talk about the victory at Republic at some point, because I think that's the way forward. But in terms of press coverage, I mentioned earlier how the labor beat as such, you know, ceases to exist slowly and so forth. And unfortunately, the only kind of coverage that labor actually gets over the last 30 years is when strikes take place. And so, you know, given that the media have a tendency to focus on the sensational and strikes are sensational, that's the kind of coverage that happens. And as all the research on this shows, strike coverage typically tends to be very anti-labor. You know, it's seen as a big inconvenience to people, to consumers. Workers are shown as being irresponsible, greedy, et cetera, et cetera. So, unfortunately, the coverage that labor does get is not positive.
Yeah, well, then I'm going to answer my own question. It's something you often do on this show. But, I mean, going back to the idea that the decline in labor coverage contributed to the decline of labor, I was explaining to David Newby before we went on the air, I was a paper boy in Cleveland for many years in the 1960s, and I read the paper cover to cover, basically, from age 10 till 16. And just reading the front page alone of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, you would have a working knowledge of at least 8 or 10 major labor figures, heads of all the key unions, George Meany, head of the AFL-CIO, and you would understand labor as one of the key political issues in a society. It was just understood that was right up there, that was something society dealt with, how workers were treated and the quality of their work and their ability to organize. And that's completely gone today. I'm willing, I could go into one of my classes and offer $1,000 to anyone who could name two labor leaders, and I wouldn't have to ever reach into my wallet, ever. And I think that's news media. That's on media. That's where I learned it. That's where people did learn it. Sure. And I recall also Tom Frank, the author who's been on the program many times, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, telling me he did some research on newspapers in the 60s, and he was astounded, too, at the amount of coverage of labor. It was just amazing to him to go back and read just daily newspapers, average ones, normal ones from around the country, not the New York Times or Washington Post necessarily, but Kansas City Star, St. Louis paper, Chicago. Their labor coverage was all over the place. So, you know, it's a long way of saying this is a key part of the picture, that such coverage just simply doesn't exist anymore. And if I can go back to you, David, I'd like to pick up a point that Deepa mentioned in her answer before, so she went off and added some content, which is, you know, the difficulty of organizing workers. She talked about the lack. You talked about how the industries, the economy changed, so the industries that were organizers were shrinking in power. She talked about the effort by those atop the government as well as the labor movement to sort of not be that interested in organizing. You've been trying to organize, I know, for 15 years here, and we've talked about your frustrations in the past. What are the barriers that you would face as the head of president of a state AFL-CIO if you wanted to organize, say, a Walmart? What would that be if you were to try to organize one of those? What would the barriers you'd face or have faced in doing that?
Well, where do I start?
We have another 40 minutes. But
first of all, Deepa does bring up a very important issue, and that is the coordinated assault by corporate America on unions to both weaken and ultimately to destroy them. And when labor began to realize that it was going to have to reorganize itself in order to regain its power, starting in the late 70s or so, very quickly, the corporate sector developed a whole new industry, if you like, of management consultants, which is now over a $5 billion industry, mm-hmm. in which you have professionals who are very expert at coming into a firm that where somebody, you know, where a group of workers are trying to organize. And they have developed techniques which are extremely difficult to counter, techniques of harassment and intimidation of workers, particularly in the industrial sector, threatening to move a plant out of the United States to Mexico or China, so that even if you have a very strong majority of workers who initially say, yes, we would like to have a union, by the time you get around to actually having an election, 2, 3, 4 months later, management has very effectively and very in a very sophisticated manner intimidated enough workers to vote no, thinking that they're going to lose their jobs if they actually vote for the union. Now, you compare that with the public sector, where, generally speaking, if workers want to organize, and if you have laws in place where public sector workers can organize, which you don't in the South, but you do in the rest of the country, it's very unusual to find public sector workers turning down forming a union where they work. Mm-hmm. It's close to 100% win record. And that is, I think, directly attributable to the fact that you don't have the intimidation, you don't have the coercion, you don't have the illegal firing of activists who are organizing within a particular firm. And as a result, people vote their interests and they vote for a union.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. You've just heard the voice of the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO, David Newby, who's joining us today on Media Matters. Also with us on the phone from New Jersey, Deepa Kumar, professor of communication at Rutgers University. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one. Rantoul, you're on the air with Deepa Kumar and David Newby.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask David, when he was speaking of the decline of union growth, if he felt like the rise of organized crime or the image of organized crime within the unions or controlling the unions had anything to do with the decline?
I really couldn't answer that. Deepa might have a much better sense of that. First of all, it's exaggerated. It always has been exaggerated. But it's been cultivated, certainly, by the anti-union forces within our society. If you compare the incidence of any kind of crime within the labor movement today with the corporate sector, there simply is no comparison. The crime is all in the corporate sector and not in the union sector. In fact, when you look at the instances where there has been some crime committed within the union sector, it's usually in smaller unions where a bookkeeper or a treasurer of a union has embezzled some funds. And for the most part, that's discovered by the unions themselves mm-hmm. and brought to the attention of the authorities. Mm-hmm. But you're certainly right. There has been a very deliberate effort to cultivate the notion that labor is controlled by the mafia, by criminal figures, and so forth. And there was a certain degree of that.
Yeah, and as an aside, David, and we're going to talk about the Freedom to Choose Act later, but already the ad campaign against this, which would make it easier for workers to organize trade unions, features one of the mobsters from Sopranos as sort of the character to sort of play on that image that organized labor and the labor movements run by the mob or connected to the mob. Deepa, do you have something you'd like to add to that?
Sure, because I actually looked at the UPS strike of 1997, and if there is a union that's associated with the mob, it would be the Teamsters with Hoffa and the mob and so on. But I want to say, though, that what I found is that, in fact, if you look at public opinion polls during the strike was in 1997, they supported the Teamsters 2-1 over UPS. And I think that speaks really to a couple of things. First of all, if you look at some of the polls around this question, somewhere between 50 to about 60% of workers say they want to join a union. And this is despite all the propaganda that David mentioned earlier and the intimidation tactics and, you know, all of the resources that corporations have to actually spread an anti-union message, because conditions have really deteriorated for the bottom 75 to 80% of Americans. So that's there. And what we saw in the case of the UPS strike is that what UPS workers and then President Ron Carey did is he generalized the conditions that UPS workers faced to Americans as a whole, and people could identify with that, and they actually saw a victory, and they said, yes, we identify with this union, we identify with these workers, and so forth. So I think you're right in that there is all sorts of, you know, rotten images of workers and mobs and so on, but I think that can easily be got around given how much, you know, workers have had to put up with in this economy over the last 30 years.
Now, just to follow up on that point, David, and you, I want each of you to respond to this if you'd like. My sense, and I might be wrong here because I'm depending on the news media for my information for the most part, my sense is that, you know, the Carey victory to become the head of the Teamsters Union was understood clearly at the time as a rejection of the old Teamsters, that it was a clean-up the act move. So the when they engaged in the UPS strike in 1997, this was the new Teamsters, a reform wing had come in. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't want to say it's exactly the same, but to some extent the election of John Sweeney to the head of the AFL-CIO in 1995, 2 years before that, well, they were, I'm not saying that it's the exact same issues, but it was seen as sort of a reform, a new generation, a new era of openness.
Absolutely. I mean, it had nothing to do with crime and mobs and so forth. But you're absolutely right. It was seen very definitely, and it was played out in terms of, you know, we need to revive the labor movement. We need to change our tactics. We need to become a much more open and progressive force within American society. Let me just add one thing to what Deepa was saying, too, with regard to people's attitudes towards unions. And that is that, you know, even though we are only 12% of the labor force, there still is a very real advantage to being a union member. I mean, union members, in terms of wages and benefits, earn about 25% more than their counterparts who are not organized.
And so, let me add also, if the unions didn't exist, the counterparts pay would even go that much further down, because having unions there probably forces other non-union employers to pay more than they would otherwise.
That's right. That's right. Now, the fact of the matter is that because of some of the factors that Deepa mentioned, neoliberalism, deregulation, privatization, and globalization, workers in general have not seen an increase in the buying power of their wages since the late 1970s. So it's been basically flat in terms of their ability to improve their standard of living, which could get us into the current meltdown of the global economy. But a lot of that, too, is related to the fact that unions don't dominate industries the way that they did before, and you add to that the privatization, the deregulation, the globalization, and you find that even though union workers have an advantage in terms of their standard of living, the American standard of living has not improved over the last 30 years.
I can just add, put a few figures to that.
Please do.
If you look at the wage gap between the average CEO and the average worker in 1978, it was about 28-1. By the turn of the century, this was 531-1. The average worker is now working, you know, several more weeks than they were back in the 1970s, but earning about the same. And in fact, you know, people like Paul Krugman, the economist and Nobel laureate, has documented quite clearly that close to the bottom 75 to 80% have actually seen their wages stagnate or deteriorate, so that it takes two wage earners today to actually have the same standard of living that it took one wage earner back in the 1970s. And it's truly astounding, this transfer of wealth from the bottom 75% to a very tiny minority. Krugman documents this very well, and he says it's not the top 10%, it's not even the top 1%, but really 13,000 families that have benefited from the gains over the last 25 to 30 years. And these people are fantastically wealthy beyond imagination, while everybody else, you know, is struggling just to get by. One more statistic. In 2005, the U.S. saw 227,000 new millionaires being created, and a survey finds that if you add the wealth of all these millionaires, it's about $30 trillion, which is more than the GDP of China, Japan, Brazil, Russia, and the EU combined. So that's the concentration of wealth in the hands of a tiny minority, while the mass majority are working longer hours, earning less, it takes two wage earners, and so forth.
Our guest today, Deepa Kumar, professor of communication at Rutgers University, who you've just been listening to, author of the book Outside the Box. Also with me here in the studio, president of the state of Wisconsin, AFL-CIO, David Newby. You've been listening to our phone numbers here at Media Matters on WILL AM 580, 333-9455. The toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Let's go to line two. Urbana, you're on the air.
I heard years ago that one of the founding principles or contracts or whatever of PBS was that they not be allowed to do programs about the labor movement. Was that true? Is it still true?
Well, I'm going to see Deepa. I think you're, of our two guests, most likely to have the answer to that. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not. I'm sorry.
I actually know a little bit. I don't know. I don't think that's true that it's in any founding documents. I think that what has happened, and what the caller may be alluding to, is that in the past, when organized labor has come to try to sponsor programming on public broadcasting that might pertain to the labor movement, they said they couldn't accept the money because it would be politically controversial, the advocacy. And labor's position was, well, you take money from businesses all the time doing business shows. Why can't you take labor? And they said, well, that's different. But I think that's what the caller must be alluding to.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, caller. You know, David, we've talked about the influence unions have upon increasing the standard of living of workers, all workers, not just union members, and the difficulty that workers, you know, that it is to organize unions, despite the fact that 50 to 60% of unorganized workers say they would like a union in this country when asked. None of them are getting unions, or very few of them are. And one of the movements that's come about is this Freedom to Choose Act, which is now being
Employee Free Choice Act.
Employee Free Choice Act. I get my jargon confused. Excuse me. And I suspect some of our listeners are familiar with this. Could you just talk a little bit about what this act does and why it's necessary? And
sure.
Maybe start with the why it's necessary. I mean, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I had you and your wife over for dinners, you know, not too long ago, and you mentioned to me something I found astounding, which is basically almost no unions in this country are even organizing anymore, at least industrial workplaces.
That's correct. In the industrial sector, it's almost impossible. And it's impossible because of two things. One is the management anti-union industry that we talked about, which is related to the fact that we have the weakest labor laws in the entire industrialized world in terms of protecting workers in all sorts of ways, but particularly in terms of their right to organize. And the reason that it's so difficult to organize is that what you have to do is, first of all, get at least 30% of the workers in a workplace to say that they want a union. And on that basis, you can ask the National Labor Relations Board to hold an election among the entire workforce. Until Taft-Hartley in the late 1940s, if a union presented 50% or signed cards, authorization cards, from members of the workforce saying that they wanted a union to represent them, present those to the employer, and the employer would have to recognize the union and start bargaining.
So that has been the law of the land here, from the late 30s into the late 40s.
That's right.
So when all the great unions we think of as the backbone of the American labor movement were formed, for the most part, steel workers, auto workers, mine workers, right on down the list, it was formed under those terms.
It was formed under those terms, or simply that, you know, workers struck for recognition and employers said, okay, we'll recognize you.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after that was that essentially the decision as to how workers would decide whether or not they want to organize was given to management. So today, you can bring in 70% signed authorization cards, workers saying if they want a union, present them to the employer, and the employer says, well, I don't care. You still have to have an election, which means that they have anywhere from 2 to 4 months, even longer, if they want to drag it out through the legal system, in order to run a very tough anti-union campaign that we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have total access to the workers. And in over 90% of union organizing drives in the private sector, you'll find that management will have one-on-one meetings between supervisors and workers. They will have meetings that workers are required to attend in which they show anti-union films. Again, all coordinated by these management anti-union firms. And so the result is that over a period of months, there is an erosion of support for the union. The union has to talk to people outside the workforce and therefore try to catch them as they're, you know, as they're coming out of their place of work or going to their homes. And so it makes it very, very difficult, particularly given the threats in the private sector to move the business, to shut it down, as well as the fact that in 25% of the organizing drives in the private sector, at least one activist who is organizing in that context is going to be illegally fired. And the union, of course, will take that to court. And it usually takes about 4 years to get that person's job back.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time, the union organizing drive has been crushed. And the amazing thing, and this illustrates the weakness of our laws, if the company is determined through the legal system, through a jury trial or whatever, to have violated the law and to have fired that person illegally, all they have to do is to make that person whole in terms of wages. In other words, they have to pay that person the difference between what they would have earned had they not been fired and what they actually earned in the intervening period.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hardly even a step on
the chump change.
And
yeah.
Really, it's an incentive for employers to fire people and to use that.
So where does the Employee Free Choice Act enter the picture? It just takes us back to recreate the conditions.
Right. It's a majority sign-up system saying that if 50% plus one of the workers in a workplace present cards, which are validated by the National Labor Relations Board, then people have a union, and the company has to recognize it. It also says that if there is not a contract agreed upon within 3 months, that there will be mediation through the National Labor Relations Board and the Federal Mediation Commission, which will, if it is unsuccessful in mediating a contract, will actually arbitrate a contract. So workers are guaranteed to have at least an initial contract. Today, when workers are successful, despite all the odds, in getting a union, in about 40% of the cases, they are never able to reach agreement with the employer because the employer simply drags out negotiations and is able to crush the union in that fashion. And that is another strategy of the anti-union firms. The final thing is that the penalties for violating labor law are improved and made to be meaningful.
This part of the Employee Free Choice Act.
Exactly.
Well, Deepa, before we go to our next caller, maybe you could shed a little more light on, you know, I know about the Employee Free Choice Act, but I obviously don't know it well enough because I had the name mangled up here, and I consider myself follows the news fairly closely. What sort of press coverage do these sort of strike-breaking activities that David Newby's been talking about get over the last 20 years in our news media? How significant are they in the consciousness of Americans? And what's your sense of the way the debate over the Employee Free Choice Act is taking place?
Right. Well, given that labor in general and strikes in general are slanted against the labor movement, the act of strike breaking, the shady things that are done in the lead up to union elections or the propaganda campaigns and so on rarely are seen as anything extraordinary, as seen as something that should be questioned and so forth, right? So, for instance, if the terms on which you cover a strike is that this is a disruption of business as usual, this is a disruption of normal life, and therefore it shouldn't be happening, then the activities, the efforts that are taken by management to end the strike or to dissolve a union and so on are seen as legitimate because it brings, you know, the status quo back, and the status quo, of course, is celebrated as the way things should be. So, in general, these sorts of activities are rarely, if ever, covered. Now, in relation to the Employee Free Choice Act, there are several websites. I haven't done any sort of systematic study as yet on this, but there are several websites that have already come up which are claiming that people should not support this act because it will do away with the secret ballot. Now, technically, I suppose that's true, because when you do a card check, when you sign cards and so on, it's not a secret ballot process. But what's left out is the fact is everything that David just mentioned, which is how difficult it is to actually have 2 to 3 or 4 months after the first round of signing cards, or everything that happens during that time to intimidate workers to not actually not actually vote in favor of the union and so forth. None of that gets mentioned. And so this propaganda is already out there. And I bet there's more of it. I haven't had the time to actually do any sort of systematic study, but I do hope, and there are a number of unions that have actually put their muscles behind the Employee Free Choice Act, and I hope that Obama will actually make it a reality. Let's see. We have to really put some pressure to make to pass this and make it a reality.
Well, I want to get to that subject in a second. Oh, David, let's go to go ahead,
yeah,
David.
First of all, if you haven't heard of the Employee Free Choice Act yet, you are. it's one of labor's top three agenda items for 2009, along with universal health care and turning the economy around and giving economic security to American workers. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already committed $100 million to fighting the Employee Free Choice Act, and that's aside what, you know, separate companies would do. The Employee Free Choice Act, which, by the way, does not outlaw secret ballots. Workers can choose to have a secret ballot if they so choose. You won't see that in any of the corporate ads, but that's the way the law is written.
Mm-hmm.
It was introduced in the last session and was voted on. It was voted on with an overwhelmingly positive vote in the House of Representatives. It was voted upon in the Senate. I believe it got 52 or 53 votes.
So it passed the Senate as well.
It passed, but it did not get to that magic number of 60 votes in order to stop a filibuster from Republican senators. And President Bush had vowed that he would veto the bill if it were actually passed. So it's been around. It has gotten majority support in both houses. And really, the question is going to be, will the supporters of that act be able to get the 60 votes that they need to stop a filibuster?
You know, it's,
and by the way, Barack Obama was a co-sponsor of that bill. He voted for it and has said that he supports it and will sign it.
Let's get back to this issue in a second, but I do want to get to our phone lines where we've had a caller waiting very patiently. If you'd like to join us, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Our two guests are David Newby, who you just heard, the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO for the past 14 or 15 years. Also on the phone lines from Rutgers, Deepa Kumar, a professor of communication and an expert on labor and media. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Champagne, line one, thank you for your great patience.
Oh, thank you. what I think would be positive, and my question is, in countries that are developing, like China, what are the chances of unions developing in those countries, and wouldn't that help with the outsourcing and the abuse of OSHA rules in other countries?
Yeah, workers of the world unite. I heard that somewhere, David.
Yeah, that's a good slogan. I like that one. It certainly would make an immense difference. And the unions that do exist in China are becoming at least somewhat more independent of the government and beginning to act more like what we think of as a union. It's going to take, however, a long, long time because China is still a very authoritarian country. But what we need to have happen, not only in China, but in other underdeveloped countries, is for the standard of living and the wages of workers in those countries to rise so that we no longer have the immense differences in wages between, say, workers in China or India and those in the United States or Western Europe.
Deepa, along these lines, I'm wondering, do you think that What do you make of the argument that sometime comes along that America really can't compete with low wages in China or out around the global south, so therefore we just can't do manufacturing anymore? That's a whole branch of the economy the United States will have to basically abandon. Or if it does keep it, it can only keep it with extreme low-wage jobs, so that certainly cannot be a labor, a unionized sector of the economy.
Well, this is not a new argument, of course. This is an argument that's been made for the last 20 to 25 years, as we've seen a process, of outsourcing and of moving. I think there's a tendency to sort of exaggerate how many companies have actually moved offshore, because I think what you've seen is at the same time as, for instance, textiles have moved outside the United States, you've also seen a movement away from union belts, from, you know, high union density cities, to the south, to the U.S. south, to North Carolina, to South Carolina, and so on and so forth. So it's not a new argument that, the U.S. cannot compete with the global economy given the so-called high wages of American workers and so forth. Now, the question, I want to come back to what David was saying earlier, which is that I think this is the key challenge, really, for the labor movement in the United States, is how to have international unionism and international solidarity, because at the end of the day, a company cannot be stopped in its tracks unless workers in Mexico, for instance, or workers in India or workers in China and so on are on the same wage level as workers in the United States, and there should be a sense of solidarity, I think, in all of this to actually prevent the loss of jobs and so forth. And I think the case of Republic, again, just to say very quickly, this was a sit-in that took place in Chicago at the Republic Windows and Doors plant, and I won't go too much into it unless you want to raise it later, Bob. One of the things that happened within days, if not hours, is that when the workers sat in, they were laid off and they were told they would not be given their severance pay and so on. Within a matter of hours, this became not just national but international news. And soon, statements of support actually came from all over the world, including the main trade union federations in France and Japan and so on. And without, again, going into too much detail, at the end of the day, within a week, they were able to actually pressure Bank of America to give the company the money to pay out their severance pay. So I think international solidarity and international unionism is really the order of the day in the globalized world that we live in.
And the fact that they actually got media attention.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because if nobody had paid any attention to that sit-in, the outcome might have been very, very different.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the whole purpose of the show, is that the press coverage of labor's activities or lack of coverage does shape the success of the labor movement. I think, Deepa Kumar, that's what you found in your study of the great UPS strike of 1997, that the press coverage was central to the success of the Teamsters Union.
Indeed. Basically, what I found, it was a strike that lasted a little over 2 weeks. And what I found is that during the first week of the strike, the coverage was very typically anti-union. Workers were seen as irresponsible. There are shipments of blood that have to go out, and these workers are actually, that's the kind of drama and sensationalism that we saw. They're lazy, they're greedy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the second week, you actually saw a real shift. What I did is I counted the number of pro-business and pro-labor and, other sources that we used during the first week of the strike. And, of course, it was disproportionately weighted towards a pro-business side. And then in the second week, it actually evens out, and you see far more people who are sympathetic, whether these are academics, whether these are labor leaders or rank-and-file workers, beginning to talk about the problems faced not just by the Teamsters, but by the American working class as a whole. And it's in that context that the mainstream media were forced to shift their coverage, because here you have, 2-to-1 support for the union. You have people identifying with the strikers and so forth. And so some sections of the media actually now began to cover this strike in a much more sympathetic way. And at the end of the strike, even Business Week, if you can believe it, actually comes out and talks about class inequality in the United States, saying that there's something wrong with the fact that the wealth that has been created over the last few decades has actually wound up in the pockets of just a handful of people, while the vast majority have, seen their wages stagnate. So that's the impact, I think, that a large strike action, actually captures the attention both of people as well as the national media can achieve. And I think that's what happened with the Republic as well. It was really a microcosm of what's happening nationally. Like, you know, on the one hand, you have the CEOs of financial institutions being bailed out despite the fact that they made all these mistakes that has landed us in the crisis, and ordinary people are not being bailed out. They're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, and Republic was really a microcosm of that. Workers were laid off, and Bank of America, which had just received $25 billion in a bailout, was refusing to lend money to the management to pay their severance pay, and I think people could relate to what these workers were up against, and the media were forced to cover it. I think Chicago Tribune did an expose as well, you know, a rare case of investigative reporting, which I thought was quite refreshing.
Well, you know, and getting back to the UPS strike, too.
Yeah, please do, David Nibby.
With having a reform administration and having not only the politics of that union change, but the fact that you would have the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which had been a dissident progressive caucus that had been organizing to make the Teamsters a progressive union for decades. You had them as essentially an organizing force within the union. Plus, you had a savvy leader in Ron Carey, and whoever came up with the phrase part-time America doesn't work, because the issue became the status of the part-time workers in UPS. So the fact that UPS was eliminating full-time jobs, putting on more part-time workers who did not get the same wages and benefits as full-time workers. And people related to that. And just as they did in the Pittston strike the next year, just as they have with the workers at the Republic Window and Door, who they simply see as, you know, a matter of fairness. And the American people, when they see that the people are being treated unfairly, they do rise to the the occasion and support people who are fighting for their rights. So I think that what that means is that as what I think is going to happen, as the American labor movement makes a comeback, not only in organizing, but when people begin to realize that we're still a major, major force in the politics of this country, that there is going to be more attention because they're finally going to realize that there's more going on here than has been reported in the mainstream media.
You know, David, let me follow up on that last point you make. It's something that I was reading recently. It struck me going through the voting patterns of Americans in the 2008 election. And what it showed was, demonstrated, was that if you look at white males with no or a high school degree, those who were members of unions voted Democratic way above those who were not union members. I mean, that was the one signifier that distinguished whether a high school graduate or no high school degree white male, their voting. And unions had managed to organize their workers to be Democrats. I don't know the exact figure. It's astounding. It's almost like a 2-to-1 figure.
I wish I brought those figures along. The fact of the matter is that Barack Obama would not be the president-elect today if the voting patterns of union members were the same as non-union members. And it is astounding. I mean, you find that in every category, and it's not just those with a high school degree. It's those with college degrees.
Yeah, that's the data I saw, yeah.
Women even more so than men, gun owners, and those who identify themselves as fundamentalist Christians. The figures are absolutely astounding, and it's basically because over the past 10, 12 years, we have gone back to basic political organizing and political education. It has not been, or the way we do politics is not a matter of simply saying to our members, this is who we think you ought to vote for. Most of the work that we do is simply doing issue comparisons between the candidates.
But you wouldn't get that sort of support if you did that. Yeah. I mean, that obviously wouldn't cut it. You know, David, I want to stop there for a second because we have two callers waiting patiently, I just noticed, and I want to make sure we get to them, one of whom on line one is all the way from Rochester, New York. So let's go to Rochester, New York right now. You're on the air with Deepa Kumar and David Nibby.
Hi, thanks a lot. Greetings from the eastern part of the Rust Belt. You know, I'm not against unions or workers' rights, certainly, but I do wonder, you know, ultimately what good unions are, at least in the industrial sector, when jobs can be exported or plants can be moved from the north to the south, even within our own country. Isn't it really the job of the labor, the union movement, to work politically to reestablish legal restraints on trade and on the ability of companies to export jobs? One other thing I'd like to suggest is, should unions perhaps get away from a focus on wages and more generally on quality of life issues? Thank you very much, folks. Bye. Bye.
Well, thank you. And maybe Deepa, would you like to comment on that first?
Maybe David should start, and
okay, David.
I'll pick up on what.
Well, let me add one thing to that, David. That occurred to me. I've been thinking. I wanted to ask, and it ties into that questions caller, which I, you know, have been alluding to all program, which is, you know, Sweden and Germany have manufacturing sectors that I don't think are much smaller today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And they're all unionized, and they pay salaries American workers would kill for, benefits American workers would die for. And, you know, how do they do it? Why can't we do it if Sweden and Germany can do it?
Well, it's primarily a matter of more investment in more sophisticated technology in Europe than you find here. And in part, that's because
labor
workers' wages are higher, and therefore the incentive is to do high-end manufacturing. And manufacturing in the United States that has survived and survived well has been higher-end manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of skill that it takes to be an industrial worker today is immensely higher than it was even 10 or 20 years ago. So, yes, manufacturing is possible. The issue of trade that the caller brought up is one which is also at the top of the agenda for the labor movement and has been ever since NAFTA, and that is to develop a level playing field internationally in terms of trade. And that doesn't mean saying that you have to have the same wages in China as you do in the United States or Sweden or Germany, but it does mean that workers in those countries ought to have the right or must have the right to organize so that they can raise their own standard of living. It means that you have to meet certain basic environmental standards so that you're not ravaging the environment and therefore cutting your costs of production unfairly. So if you have international standards of those sorts that any country can actually meet, then American workers and Western European workers can compete on a level playing field.
You know, we've only got a few seconds left. I do want to try to get this last caller in. So let's go to Urbana, line 4. You're on the air with David Newby and Deepa Kumar.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Fine. Hey. If you can make this a short question, you'll be
a
fan.
Really short question.
I'll be
How do you feel that the UAW has interacted with the big three auto workers? And do you think that their interactions as far as their demands have led to the demise of the big three, and comparison to a non-union, say a Toyota plant or whatever?
Great question. Do your best, David.
Okay, absolutely not. The cost of labor is only 10% of the cost of an automobile, and so therefore wages are a minor factor. Plus, you find that the difference between UAW wages and those of unorganized transplants like Toyota or Honda are not actually that much different. The difference is that General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford have been around a lot longer, and they also have, the unions have negotiated medical benefits for their retirees, which are expensive and which the non-union plants don't have.
David Newby, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's a pleasure having you here.
It's been great.
Deepa Kumar, they're off in New Jersey. I hope the weather's better there than it is here.
It is, I hope.
For everyone's sake. And thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters, and good luck with your future work.
Thank you.
Bob McChesney. I want to thank Bob Naiman for being my producer today, and I want to thank Kyle Kroha for being the engineer working the board. I'll be back in 167 hours on the show. Happy New Year, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
today in Champaign-Urbana, meteorologist Dan Pounder says mostly to partly sunny. We've already hit our high, and the temperature will continue to drop during the day. Wind from the northwest at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tonight, clearing up and turning colder, the low 14 degrees, wind from the northwest at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and clouds increasing during the afternoon, the high 33. You're listening to WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.